listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works. This is episode 97 of the Common Good Podcast with co-host Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Today we feature part two of a conversation with Bill Ryerson of the Population Media Center on reducing human population through methods that work.
I'm glad you're with us as we head into the second part of this conversation on population control. Now, here's a reminder, as we do so, of the enormous explosion in numbers of humans that have arrived on planet Earth really recently. If you think in terms of geological times of millions of years, I mean, just think of this. Today, Homo sapiens, are by far the top predators on the planet. Our numbers have doubled since, you know, not since 1700, but since 1970, just 48 years ago. During the 20th century, world population grew from 1.6 billion to 6 billion. In this 21st century, the rate of growth is actually going down. Perhaps we should find some hope there. But we're at 7.6 billion, we're still going up, and people are talking a lot about 9 billion of our species later in this century. Well, in some countries, as I said, population is going down. What's working in those countries? What are they doing differently? And just what are the most effective ways we found to reduce human population? What would be a healthy, sustainable balance of humans with all other species? These are the taboo subjects. I say taboo because lots of people just don't want to talk about them. So the taboo subjects of this daunting topic, and we're sure that Bill Ryerson will give us some illuminating thoughts as he's been studying this topic for years.
Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
And I greet you, Jerry, from San Diego and Jubilee Economics Ministries.
Friend and colleague Peter Sautel from Echo Justice Ministries recently wrote to me, "Whenever the subject of population comes up, I'll quote a quip that I heard many years ago. If you want to have unproductive political battles, talk about the population problem. If you want to do something about population, work for the education of women, widespread basic health care, including contraception, and the elimination of stark poverty." Peter goes on, "Your essay works in that direction in looking for the practical steps to slow population growth. As I look back, I've written two commentaries or blogs dealing specifically with population over the years. First, The Population Problem. Second, 7 billion and Rising. Both of those, and perhaps your essay, are out of date in the projection for 2050 population. I'd been referring to figures that looked for a slowing of the population growth curve by then and leveling off at about 9 billion. I've heard more recently that explosive growth in Central Africa is steepening the curve and pointing toward even higher numbers." See the links to Peter's two blogs in the show notes for this episode. Conversations about overpopulation tend to raise gut reactions, such as, "What about China's one-child policy?" Or, "I couldn't possibly suggest to a woman from another culture how many children to have." I find the work of Population Media Center so encouraging, I won't spoil their story, but it's profound.
So there you can see how varied the conversation and scenarios go, huh? Because I had just talked about arriving at 9 billion later this century. And you've already said, Jerry, quoting Peter, that it could go even higher than that. So this is an incredibly difficult thing to get a hold of. And yet there are important things to be said about it, vitally important, as we go on. As we pick up The second part of our conversation with Bill Ryerson, we pick it up where he is talking about David Pimentel. I wrote about David Pimentel in my book, Blinded by Progress, and I'd like to read a quotation from that because it really addresses what we're talking about here with the numbers of people that our planet can sustain. So here goes the quote. In 1999, David Pimentel, Cornell University biology professor, estimated 2 billion people was Earth's long-term carrying capacity. More recently, the science of ecological footprinting, which measures Earth's biological production against human demand to consume, has come up with the figure of 5 billion people, putting us already 2 billion over Earth's limits. Both of these calculations take the question of how many people to a deeper level, namely that of considering our interdependence with the millions of other species on Earth. We know we need millions of species in order for our species to survive. The most basic question can no longer be how many Homo sapiens can Earth sustain, but how many Homo sapiens and other species can inhabit Earth in a life-sustaining balance.
Before the end of this century, for better or worse, human civilization will almost 100% be dependent just on renewables. And looking at just renewables, some scientists have done some very interesting projections of what number of people could be sustained by renewable resources at a decent quality of life. For example, Cornell biologist David Pimentel did a detailed analysis based on the assumption that people would be living at the Western European lifestyle. And on that assumption, with renewable resources only, the world could sustain 2 billion people. Since we're now at 7.5 billion, we clearly have a problem unless we want to live far more meager lives. So, you know, maybe 7 billion could be kept alive at the Ethiopian lifestyle. I don't think anybody's done that analysis because people really want to live healthy, well-fed, and economically comfortable lives. So looking at the data Pimentel put together, it's pretty clear we need to dramatically bring about changes in desired and actual family size and move society to the point that we actually have below replacement level fertility and can bring the population down to a sustainable level before nature forces our hand through rapid increase in mortality rate. And it's clear to me, and this is really that gets us over to the Population Media Center and why it exists, it's clear to me that the reasons people are having larger families have to do primarily with social norms. The only paper I remember from freshman psychology is a paper by Solomon Ash at Harvard about his research on conformism. And what his experiments consisted of was a room full of supposed subjects, but actually only one of them was the real subject, and the rest had all been instructed to give the wrong answer. And then he'd do something like draw two lines of different length on the blackboard and pretend it was a study in visual perception and ask each person to name which line was longer, and they'd all name the shorter line as longer. And finally, he'd get to the uninformed subject, who almost always named the shorter line as longer. So it's very clear from that research that people are driven to fit into what they perceive to be the norm, and that changing norms on all kinds of issues requires changing the perception of what is normal. So, for example, in northern Nigeria, say I'm a boy growing up in northern Nigeria, and my parents have 10 children, and my sisters are sold into marriage at age 12, and my father beats my mother. Well, that's going to be my norm as to how family life occurs unless something intervenes to change that. So just to give you a little bit of data from the demographic and health surveys, in Nigeria, fertility rate is 5.7 children per woman. So the average woman during her lifetime, reproductive lifetime, has 5.7 children. When women are asked how many children they think is ideal, they say 7. Men say 9. In Niger, with the highest fertility rate on the planet, 7.6, when women are asked how many children they think is ideal, they say 11. Men say 13. So in much of West Africa, desired family size is higher than the actual fertility rate. And huge numbers of people give an answer to the question of why are you not using a method of contraception as wanting more children or wanting as many children as possible. So how do we change those norms in a human rights context? Well, we know from, let's take Thailand. Thailand had 6 children per woman. Now it has 1.8. How did that happen? Well, that country used a number of communication strategies, including very clever work by a social marketer named Michai Virabhadraya, to change perceptions of the public with regard to what is the ideal number of children and how does a smaller family size lead to improved health and economic welfare. And Thailand went fairly quickly from very high reproductive rates to below replacement level fertility. So Population Media Center is using a similar strategy, although based on, as I mentioned earlier with the work of the Population Institute, based on the work of Miguel Sabido. Sabido went to meet another psychologist, Albert Bandura, at Stanford in the 1970s to understand how his telenovelas were influencing the behavior of the audience with regard to hairstyles and clothing styles and names of children and other things. And he studied Bandura's social learning theory and social cognitive theory, and then, which is all about how role models influence the behavior of observers and what makes a role model more or less influential. And then he created this whole strategy for the use of melodrama with good and evil characters that occur in all melodrama, battling over various issues. And then middle-of-the-road characters designed as charismatic role models for segments of the audience who get conflicting advice about their own lives from the positive and negative characters. And over time, as the shows gain audience, and the audience falls in love with these characters that are just like them, these characters then sort out who's right and who's wrong, and they evolve into positive role models, showing the audience the benefits of the new behavior and showing the audience how to deal with the pushback that comes when somebody tries something innovative. So, for example, in northern Nigeria, we did a show in which key characters evolved into the decision to have smaller families, to delay childbearing until adulthood, to stop child marriage, and to use family planning. And that show, which was 208 episodes across 4 states in northern Nigeria, Kano, Kaduna, Katsina, and Sokoto states, attracted 67% of the public as regular listeners. And at clinics offering family planning services, new clients were asked what had motivated the visit. And 2/3 of them named that program by name. Similarly, in Sierra Leone, with half the population listening to a 208-episode program we did there on radio, as in Nigeria, because radio is still the dominant medium, we had half the population listening at least weekly, and at clinics, 1,500 people were interviewed, being asked why they had come for family planning, and 50% of them named Sally Wansai, the name of our program. So these shows, without ever telling the audience what to do, are modeling behaviors based on the policies of the host country, and which are, in every case where we're working, in favor of promoting family planning use and smaller family norms and delaying marriage and childbearing until adulthood. And they're having profound effects on behavior and the audience who are writing thousands of letters and text messages to us and to the radio stations are thanking us for the information that they didn't have before on how to limit family size or the benefits of smaller family norms or the benefits of sending their daughter to school as opposed to marrying her off at puberty. In Ethiopia, where we've done 8 of these kinds of programs on Radio Ethiopia, the first one attracted 46% of the population as regular listeners, and it modeled family planning use and HIV testing, as well as stopping marriage by abduction, which is basically rape, and then the woman is forced to marry her rapist to prevent the family from having some kind of shame. And with 46% of the population listening, the surveys that were conducted baseline and post-broadcast, so just before and just after the 2-year program, showed that married women went from 14% self-reported use of modern methods of contraception at the baseline to 40% by the end of the program, so almost a tripling, while non-listeners had a slight increase. And the increase among listeners was 2.5 times what occurred among non-listeners. And male listeners reported seeking an HIV test at 4 times the rate of non-listeners. Female listeners reported seeking an HIV test at 3 times the rate of non-listeners. And among the 25,000 letters that came by post in response to that program, one of them said, "Thank you for dealing with the issue of marriage by abduction. Our own daughter was abducted on her way to school at age 14 and ended up married as a result. And we have been afraid to send the 12-year-old girls to school for fear the same thing would happen to them. When your program addressed this issue through the character Wu Balam, our entire village, almost everybody of which was listening to the program, came together and we agreed to enforce the law against marriage by abduction, which we hadn't known existed, and now it is safe for the 12-year-old girls to go to school. Please keep your program on the air." So we get that kind of qualitative information from our listeners, as well as very compelling quantitative information that shows that these programs are having huge effects on attitudes and behavior of the audience around the world with regard to issues that are driving population growth and driving poor health and human rights violations as well.
We'll return momentarily to our conversation with Bill Ryerson on reducing human population through methods that work. Let me take this moment here in the break to say that in Jubilee Economics Ministries, we've been moving into a collaboration with another organization that has used the name Jubilee with great effectiveness, Jubilee USA Network. They've distinguished themselves in being able to lobby legislation for reduction of debt, onerous debt incurred by countries that will never get out of debt as they pay on that debt, always toward richer countries, and at a rate that never pays off the debt. So it's an incredible enslavement. Well, Jubilee USA Network has been effective in that. They've now moved into other realms as well, including student debt, which is an important topic. I'm really happy that we're moving along in creating a kind of presentation or curriculum, perhaps it'll grow into, for Jubilee congregations on deepening their understanding of the biblical Jubilee. We'll be addressing the biblical Jubilee in the Bible. We'll be addressing actions in the current world that are Jubilee. We'll be addressing also 13 essential themes of Jubilee. So more on that collaboration as time goes by. Now let's return to our conversation with Bill Ryerson.
That's very encouraging, Bill. What I'm wondering is whether the governments and the nonprofit organizations working in those countries are able to meet the need. That is, do they provide contraception? Do they provide abortion? Do they provide sterilization upon request? Or is there no more demand than they can meet?
In fact, in the demographic and health surveys, it's pretty clear that lack of access is a very minor reason for non-use of contraception. So, for example, in Nigeria, only 0.2% cite that as a reason, 0.2% cite cost as the reason for non-use of contraception. And over 95% in most countries can identify where they can obtain contraception. So excessive demand is not the primary problem, although there's a belief by many that that must be the problem, but indeed it's not. And of course, it's important to increase service provision as demand increases. So we work very closely with the governments and with the non-governmental organizations that are providing services and make them part of an advisory committee for the writing team in each country where we're doing one of these programs. We've now worked in 50 countries. And so they are both helping the writers understand how to address each issue effectively and accurately, and being prepped for knowing when they're going to need to have increased service availability to meet the increased demand that we can generate. So we're very intent on not creating demand for services that can't be met, and so far we haven't seen that happen.
Organizations in the U.S., let's say churches, for example, even progressive churches like mine, the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, are focusing on maternal care and on feeding the hungry. I'm just wondering if that's what we should continue doing, or if there's some other things that we should be doing. Are there some organizations that you would like to highlight in addition to your own that are doing really good work that we should support?
Well, certainly there are churches that have been very outspoken on the need for sexuality education and the need for family planning services. And so I think it's really important in a place like the U.S. for all churches that are supportive of family planning and sexuality education to be very vocal, because there's an unprecedented attack in the U.S. on such services and education programs now. Incidentally, Population Media Center has started doing its own U.S. TV shows. We have donors who are very interested in seeing us address the issue of teenage pregnancy in this country. So we did a show starting in 2013 on Hulu called East Los High, as in Los Angeles, where it was filmed, East Los Angeles. East Los High is a fictional high school that is filled with primarily Hispanic teens who have the highest rates of teen pregnancy in the U.S. And it's an English language program, and one can listen to or watch this program on Hulu or at eastloshigh.com. And it ran for 5 years and became the number one show on Hulu Latino and in the top five on all of Hulu, and was nominated for 6 Emmy Awards. And it's provided a huge amount of education to its audience about contraception, the morning after pill, abortion, sexuality information, domestic violence and date rape, and a whole array of other issues that affected the Hispanic population. And because it has been such a success story, for example, 27,000 people linked from the show's website to Planned Parenthood's website just in the first month of this 5-year program, that we've decided to go ahead and do additional programs in the U.S. So we have several programs at various stages of development now that we anticipate will go on the air in the next year or two, because this country is very important in terms of its population issue. And as you mentioned, we have high rates of consumption. So reducing population growth in a place like the U.S. is critically important. And so we're working to use this entertainment strategy to provide informal sexuality education to the public. But it's also very important for the churches to support formal sexuality education and science-based education in our schools.
Thank you, Bill. That's encouraging. Now, how might listeners support the Population Institute or Population Media Center? How are you funded in general?
Both organizations accept donations. They're both 501c3 charitable organizations, and they accept donations via their website. So the Institute is largely supported by individuals and foundations. Population Media Center is supported by individuals, foundations, UN agencies, and various governments. 8 different governments around the world have supported our work, including the government of Ethiopia. And so people should sign up for the various information pieces we send out by regular emails at populationmedia.org and populationinstitute.org. And there are donate buttons on both of those websites where people can make an online donation using a credit card, as well as information on how to mail a check to support the organizations.
Thank you so much, Bill.
On June 15th, which happens to be the day of the 20th anniversary of Population Media Center's founding.
We think of you as a think tank. You're obviously doing a lot with media, so you're an educational organization. I don't see you as what you would call a frontline organization, you know, distributing services, actual population services. Maybe I'm wrong. What other organizations besides Planned Parenthood would you recognize? Would you recommend that we support?
Certainly, the Institute is something of a think tank in terms of putting out scholarly publications, and Bob Walker's working on a book, and the Global Media Award event, and other activities of the Institute. Population Media Center is focused on use of entertainment mass media for behavior change communications or social change communications. And one thing I should mention is that the cost per attributable behavior change of the strategy that Population Media Center uses is the lowest of any cost we've been able to measure around the world, which is why we use this strategy. But then neither organization is providing contraceptive services. Certainly PMC is working all over the world, but not provision of contraceptive services. And we work very closely with the service providers that include Planned Parenthood and its international Planned Parenthood affiliates around the world, as well as Population Services International and Marie Stopes International. Marie Stopes is a British-based organization that does family planning and reproductive health services. So those are two partners that we've worked very closely with that are in the service provision. Population Services International does social marketing of various types of contraceptives, and they are, in some countries, one of the biggest providers of contraceptive services in the country, even exceeding the Ministry of Health. So they're a very important organization based in Washington that have been around also since the late 60s or early 70s.
Thank you so much, Bill. Keep up the good work. I hope we can talk again sometime.
All right, Jerry. Thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation, and you keep up your good work, too.
You've been listening to our conversation with Bill Ryerson of the Population Media Center on reducing human population through methods that work. In upcoming episodes, of our podcasts. We'll hear from participants as they return from the Jubilee delegation to Chiapas, Mexico. We'll learn about One Earth Living from the Zapatista movement. We're also going to listen or hear from John Deere, that'll be in July, author and activist for peace and nonviolence, who's helping plan the International Peace Week in mid-September. His latest book is They Will Inherit the Earth, Peace and Nonviolence in a Time of Climate Change. Also want to look back, not only looking forward to future episodes, but back on recent episodes. In early June, we hosted Bonnie Tarwater, pastor of the Church of Our Common Home. In April and May, we hosted economist Susan Taylor of Just Financial Advisors in a three-part series on her recent book, What About Our Money? A Faith Response. We hope you'll be able to listen to them, and that if you do, you're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. I know we picked up new ideas just interviewing them.
Also, please subscribe to my Simpler Living Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of Lee's blogs, the Common Good podcast, Simple Living Works podcast, and other intriguing happenings and events, such as Non-Conform Freely celebrations, ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumerism. Would you like to donate to the Common Good Podcast? Just click on the Donate button. Jubilee is a mostly volunteer 501c3 nonprofit organization, so your donations are tax-deductible. Donate $50 or more all at once or in quarterly payments and receive, upon request, an autographed copy of Lee's book, From Egos to Eden, Our Heroic Journey to Keep Earth Livable. By donating, you'll know that in this time of crisis, you're making a difference. Please give us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on the Common Good Podcast and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Time to wrap up this episode. If you're a regular listener, you've heard our closing comments, so we'll say goodbye now. But if you're a newer listener, here's what we'd like you to know about the podcast. Please subscribe to our Jubilee Economics, One Earth, and Simple Living Works blogs. We post new nearly every week, so if you're a subscriber, you'll be told when we post something new. Subscriptions are free. Subscribe to our blogs through our websites. You can also subscribe to the Common Good Podcast and Simple Living Works Podcast at iTunes or your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of the Common Good Podcast and Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.
We're going to start this second part of our conversation with Bill Ryerson, where Bill starts to talk about his conversation.
I'm sorry, I found your introduction to
Pimentel
a little confusing. I was wondering if you wanted to just read it the way you wrote it.
Book that I wrote, Blinded by Progress.
Because your references back and forth to him and your writings and the numbers.
A paragraph from that book as a lead-in into part two of our conversation with Bill. Here it is. In 1999, David Pimentel, Cornell University biology professor, estimated 2 billion people was Earth's long-term carrying capacity. Now, just compare that. This is not the quote. I'm breaking in on the quote. But compare that to the 9 billion and over that we just referred to. 2 billion is Earth's long-term carrying capacity. Now, back to Pimentel. More recent, or actually, this is the quote from me, from my book, pardon me. More recently, the science of ecological footprinting, which measures Earth's biological production against human demand to consume, has come up with a figure of 5 billion people, putting us already 2 billion and a half over Earth's limits. Well, both of these calculations, 2 billion or 5 billion, take the question of how many people to a deeper level, namely that of considering our interdependence with the millions of other species on Earth. We know we need millions of species in order for our species to survive. The most basic question can no longer be how many Homo sapiens can Earth sustain. It has to be how many Homo sapiens and other species can inhabit Earth in a life-sustaining balance. Well, be listening for that as we move on now into part two of Jerry's conversation with Bill Ryerson. At the very time when species extinctions are happening faster than at any moment since 65 million years ago when dinosaur populations collapsed, one species, Homo sapiens, is in a burst of exponential growth. Now numbering 7.6 billion, our rise to become the overwhelmingly dominant species on the planet carries with it the harbinger of catastrophic decline. Because nature's ecosystems seek balance, no species has ever remained overwhelmingly dominant for long. Theoretically, it is possible that Homo sapiens, having evolved a high level of intelligence, will choose actions that cooperate with nature in reestablishing a balance among species. But current trends indicate that our species will need to be brought back into balance through disaster, disease, and death, just as happens with other species when they have risen to dominate the resources of a region and destroyed the balance of the planet. The multi-Earth worldview is proving to be especially ineffective in dealing with population growth. And why? Well, that's what we're going to be doing in this podcast today, exploring that. Stay with us. And greetings to you, Jerry, from San Diego and Jubilee Economics. So what I just presented before we greeted each other was actually the opening paragraph from the chapter on population and species balance in my book, Blinded by Progress. So as we start this two-part series on human population, it's such a challenging issue that lots of people just don't tackle it. So much denial around this, so much taboo is probably a better word, so much taboo in talking about it. Well, I'm one who says at this point there really isn't any way that we can be stewards of this planet with the top predator, meaning us, continuing to expand numbers and doing so explosively. So that's my basic position. And another paragraph to say a little bit more about how I see this, another paragraph from the chapter I wrote a couple years ago, our growth rate exceeds our consciousness to even calculate its impact. And all of us, scientists included, are scrambling to come up with a framework in which to discuss this rapid takeover of our planet by our own species. E. Wilson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist who's retired now from Harvard, has described this unusually rapid numerical growth by a species of primates, Homo sapiens, as more bacterial than primate. He calculates that human biomass is already 100 times larger than that of any other large animal species that has ever walked the earth. All species, including our own, are reeling from our heavy footprint upon our planet. Well, as I say, that's what I wrote a couple of years ago, but that's pretty much where I am right now. I was trying at that point to just delve into this thing of why are we just not able to cope with this explosion of our species? Why can't we exercise some point of control? So that's where I still am, and most essentially I'm saying, you know, feeding 9 billion people, I don't think it's going to come to that. I don't see us being, by our planet, able to allow that with all the species we'd have to displace. So where are you as we begin this topic, Jerry? You mean from the beginning or what? No, I mean that didn't happen. That didn't happen. So, am I still muffled now? I have no idea. I've just sat here. You know, I'm just sitting here talking into it about the distance I usually do. So, I mean, I can reread something if you want, or... We'll return momentarily to Jerry's conversation with Bill Ryerson on the crises caused by exploding human population, and these crises are everywhere. Well, let me take a moment here to announce that I'll be traveling in the Midwest at the end of June and early July, so listeners from that area, can we perhaps meet up? I'll be in Chicago area June 26, 27, and 28. And then in Lincoln, Nebraska on July 2 and 3. I'll have copies of my books with me to share and sign. The meetings will be about Jubilee circles and engaging the ecological crises that are taking over the lives of millions of species, including our own. Well, I look forward to talking with some of you and learning from you how you are coping with the overwhelming crises growing around us. More details of where I'm speaking are on the events page of the One Earth Project. And that's the website, the One Earth Project, all one word, .com/events. See the other written, or I'll see the written introduction to this podcast or the show notes to this podcast for those links. So let's return now to Jerry's conversation with Bill Ryerson. You've been listening to our conversation with Bill Ryerson of the Population Media Center on the crises caused by exploding human population. The early July episode features Bill Ryerson, and that's the next episode that we have of the podcast. It features Bill Ryerson on the second part of this conversation. It will be entitled Reducing Human Population Through Methods That Work. Have you listened to our recent episodes? In early June, we hosted Bonnie Tarwater, pastor of the Church for Our Common Home. She was talking about new kinds of structures emerging in which the church really connects more profoundly with the earth. In April and May, we hosted economist Susan Taylor of Just Financial Advisors in a three-part series on her new book, What About Our Money? A Faith Response. Very worthwhile book, and I do hope you'll listen to that three-part series. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes.